Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're without Paul Venable again. I really love having Paul as a part of the show because his commentaries, questions, and because he points out, hey, that didn't make sense. And a lot of times if I've covered something, sometimes I don't do it because I try to. I try to highlight what's really important. And so, you know, in some cases, you know, Paul and I can go down rat holes. And I think in a lot of ways that really does help. The more information people get, me myself, I don't have a lot of patience, and I've developed patience. I wasn't born with a lot of patience, and I think that was one of the reasons why the Lord, you know, led me to my beautiful bride, because she has taught me patience and its importance and so forth. Now, one of the things I'm going to say, because I'm going to end up putting all of these documents up on the website, just like the ratification debates, these documents need to go up on the website. And actually, once you hear this show, the website should be already updated to this show. And so that way, you know, we'll, because this show should actually be up before you even hear it, because I am pre-recording this just due to the my circumstances as they have been dealt to me, because we had some weather events over the weekend that have required my full attention, which forced me to literally have to refocus on trying to get this done, because these weather events are forcing me to have to do a bunch of other things outside of the house during this coming week, or during this week that you hear this show. So anyway, this is why we're doing this. But anywho, moving forward, we're on the 14th paragraph. And so Madison basically has kind of, I went through, you know, the whole point of why we have to interpose, and he's not done. He's not even close to being done. We're on page 2 of 13, and almost through to the second of 13. And this is what he says with paragraph 14. In the third place, the nullifying claim for a single state is blatantly irreconcilable, or palpably irreconcilable, with the effect contemplated by the interposition claimed by the resolution for the parties to the Constitution, namely that, quote, within the respective limits of the states and the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. Nothing can be more clear than that. These authorities of the states, in other words, the authority and laws of the United States, must be the same in all, or that this cannot continue to be the case if there be a right to each to annul, suspend within itself the operational laws and authority of the whole U.S. There cannot be different laws in different states. Do you understand this, folks? On subjects within the compact, without subverting the fundamental principles and rendering it as abortive in practice, as it would be incongruous in theory. In other words, how are we a union if we are not abiding by the laws together? We have to work together. In other words, you create a union, it actually obligates you to do some very specific things. You have to have oversight over this compact. You need to get more active and engaged in holding this little creature you created accountable. Because I'm telling you, folks, the avarice exists in everything, especially when it comes to politics. And this little creature has been getting away with murder, literally, and actually, as we have proven this past year, And we've made the case that we have been under warfare tactics by our own government for, you know, decades, almost a half century, no, actually over a half century, right? Back in the teens, it was a half century, over a half century, because most of these warfare tactics actually got unleashed in the 60s. And some other tactics were unleashed even well before that. But I mean, the magnitude that started forcing us down this path and actually diverting our economic powers and everything else to where they started seizing controls well beyond, so far beyond the scope. And the question is, why? How did we allow this to happen? Because we became ignorant and uneducated, and we were actually indoctrinated to believe the Constitution was something else, that the federal government, you know, that it was this living document. It seemed like everybody just, you know, I guess when kids hear this concept of, oh, the federal government is this really great, noble entity that has this living document to make sure it can change to our needs. And the kids go, oh, that's so great. Oh, boy, I love government. I mean, I'm just trying to give you my two cents as to how we got into this mess. How many of us, and when I say it's not just our kids today, there were kids my age in schools that thought and heard these messages. That's why, I mean, as E.G. Edward Griffin basically pointed out, the collectivism and these principles were taught when he was going to school in the 30s and the 40s. He was born in the time of my parents. And I'm here to tell you, he was so right. This is why our parents, or I should say, that great generation did nothing when the federal government created Social Security. They did nothing. But they're the greatest generation? Why? Well, hey, if they did that, then they must be great. No, because they did that, they were the first generation of, I'll just say it, imbeciles. I had this conversation with my father before he passed. I said, why is it that you're labeled the greatest generation when you were the first generation to concede and allow collectivism to start forming in America? You should have been the resistance. You should have showed the example. So why is it that academia and, you know, the intelligentsia labels you as the greatest generation? When I see you were the principal, you know, you were the straw that broke the camel's back. And it's just been downhill since. We have to actually not allow this revisionist of history allow people to really believe. Yeah, they may have answered their nation's call to stopping despots, but they actually sold their nation out by embracing this unconstitutional, terrible, terrible scheme called Social Security. It broke Britain. Not Britain, because Otto von Bismarck of Germany in the 1800s implemented Social Security, and it broke them. And so they went back through, and actually it drove them into World War I because they became so destitute and desperate that they had to start taking land so they could grow food because they were too populated and just didn't have the means of feeding themselves. And so it was just easier to fight a war along, and there were a lot of other things in play, but the big justification was they had to do this. And then they were excoriated so badly and punished so hard, it forced them into their next war. It forced them to accept the flattery of the evil man Adolf Hitler, to rise from the ranks and convince them that, you know, they were entitled, that they had to do these things. And, oh boy, were they wrong. I mean, that's why Germany, I see, is probably going to be integral in the Third World War. Now, let's what Martin Luther did was correct. and what I say by correct in creating a movement, in using petitions, the power of petitions and educating people, that is the correct process. But I find it ironic that the nation that created the Reformation of Christianity, the Germanic states, was the birthplace of two world wars. And I'm submitting that it will be the birthplace of the third, possibly. Possibly. But we all know that Israel will be the Armageddon War. And as we see what's going on in the Ukraine and so forth, who knows? I really don't. Other than I just know, folks, that the evil powers that are moving and pushing this world into this unified godlessness, it's all going to be under the perception of a god, a demigod. We need to start demanding full compliance of our Constitution so we can pull back, so we can break the chains that the globalists have on us. You know, go read the medical freedom petition so you can understand what we need to do in addressing people like Bill Gates and the rest of the affluent people in America. And we need to stabilize this economy. And we need to actually really start reconsidering, you know, our property rights and those types of things. And I'll get into that a little bit later. I'm going to give you some Jeffersonian theories that was so insightful that it really rings today of a direction that we really need to go. As a matter of fact, Madison, you know, I haven't gone through the details, but Madison comes back and says, huh, this is kind of interesting. Anyway, but I only have two letters. That's all I have of the dialogue regarding this topic. But I believe we really need to place context to it today, because our current system, our current paradigm of property rights allows Bill Gates to actually conduct warfare tactics against the states. Anyway, moving on, this is in paragraph 14, this is what Madison continues to say. A concurrence and cooperation of the states in favor of each would have the effect of preserving the necessary uniformity in all which the Constitution so carefully and specifically provided for in cases where the rule might be most in danger of being violated. Thus, the citizens of every state are to enjoy reciprocally the privileges of the citizens of every other state. Direct taxes are to be apportioned on all according to a fixed rule. I need to highlight this, folks, because I need to point out that the intent behind the uniformity clause was this, and this very specifically. And so what I'm doing here is I'm actually pointing out in this particular passage, because with, you know, hot pink and yellow, that when it came down to the suffering, it wasn't this equal suffering by the states. We were all to carry the load equally, you know, so that somehow the state, even though maybe you specifically couldn't carry the load and somebody else had to, it was still evenly shared as the states basically moved the burden of the direct tax by apportionment to the people of the state. It had to be done uniformly. The federal government does not have the ability to create progressive taxation. The uniformity rule, as he just says here, direct taxes are to be apportioned on all according to a fixed rule. And when you look at the 16th Amendment, they did not bypass that uniformity fixed rule, that they had they strictly had the ability without proportion to directly tax the people and or income, because they knew going down the path that the more productive states could actually be taxed, because the more corporations, the more businesses you have, because they knew that this was going to be moved down this path. I think the playbook was handed to everybody. That's why the court created the rule that a corporation is an individual, which it has to pay income tax, but it also has the equal right of having a say in elections and so forth, and started going down this path that it had equal rights in representation and all these things. And no, that's not true. And as a matter of fact, corporations should never have been brought in under this income tax, under the income tax rule, because the federal government still had no ability to even regulate or even acknowledge corporations. They just created an income tax, and that income tax was sold and decided to be on the people directly. And they started shifting and redefining it, and that's exactly what they did. They started redefining the 14th Amendment. They started redefining the 16th Amendment, and they even redefined the Constitution with the 17th Amendment. The progressives understood where their barriers were. They created punched a hole in the Constitution with the 16th and 17th Amendments, not the 14th. And then they started redefining it to aggrandize themselves. With the 14th Amendment, they completely perverted it by using redefinitions. And that's how the court's been doing this. Believe me, the court has been very, very culpable in undermining us. Anyway, moving on in paragraph 14, indirect taxes are to be the same in all the states. The duties on imports are to be uniform. No preference is to be given to the ports of one state over those of another. So as it comes down, everything had to be uniform. That was the fundamental principle. If you understand what he's really saying here, folks, this is an inseparable part of this union. The requirement of uniformity. And in this particular case of nullifying laws, it requires a uniformity of the states, but not a full union. When it comes to violations, we only need a majority. Can it be believed that with these provisions of the Constitution illustrating its vital principles fully in view of the legislature of Virginia, that its members could be, in the resolution quoted, intended to countenance a right in a single state to distinguish itself from co-states by avoiding the burdens or restrictions borne by them, or indirectly given the law to them? These startling consequences from the nullifying doctrine have driven its partisans to the extravagant presumption that no state would ever be so unreasonable, unjust, and impolitic as to avail itself to its right in any case not so palpable, just, and fair as to ensure the concurrence of the others, or at least the requisite proportion of them. So going into paragraph 16, there's a lot here. There's a bunch of gold, and we'll get into this. Omitting the obvious remark that in such a case, the law would never have been passed or immediately repealed, and the surprise that such a defense of the nullifying right should come from South Carolina in the 10th, and at the same time, her own example, the presumption of such forbearance in each of the states, or such a pliability in all among 20 or 30 independent sovereignties, must be regarded as a mockery by those who reflect for a moment on the human character, or consult the lessons of experience, not the experience only of other countries and times, but that among ourselves, and not only under the former defective confederation, but since the improved system took place of it, examples of differences preserving differences among the states on the constitutionality of federal acts will readily occur to everyone, and which would error this have defaced and demolished the Union, that the nullifying claim of South Carolina been indiscriminately exercisable in some of the states, the carriage tax would have then been collected, in others unpaid. In some, the tariffs on imports would be collected, others would openly resist. In some, lighthouses would be established, in others denounced. In some states, there might be war with a foreign power, in others, peace and commerce. Finally, the appellate authority of the Supreme Court of the United States would give effect to the federal laws in some states, whilst in others, they would be rendered nullities by state judiciaries. In a word, nullifying claims, if reduced to practice instead of being conservative principle of the Constitution, would necessarily, and it may be said obviously, a deadly poison. Can't say much more about that other than the fact that when you start nullifying, all it does is it leads to anarchy, and it makes it impossible for us to get our heads straight. It makes it impossible to fight back on all of the issues. I mean, in their particular case, they were only looking at a couple of acts. Today, folks, it's in the hundreds. It is that bad. So what do? We have to demand full compliance. All of these organizations out there that say, oh, we can't allow this one law. We can't allow this one law. And accept all the rest of them? Is that what they're saying? Oh, well, this law is bad and we can't allow it, but, you know, we don't care about the rest of them. That's the same thing. That's why I tell you, those who are against abortion, but not in support of enforcing the complete Constitution, are misguided and misleading people. It is all repugnant. It is all evil. Even in the slightest degree, evil is evil. You can't redefine it. It is of its source. It will be, from its source, always evil. Thus, from the third resolution itself, whether regard be had to the employment of the term states in the plural number, or the plural tense, to the argumentative use of it, or to the object, namely, the, quote, maintaining the authorities and rights of each, must be the same in all as in each, it is manifest that the adequate interposition to which it relates must be not a single but a concurrent interposition. If we pass the third to the seventh resolution, which though it repeats and reinforces the third, and which is always skipped over by the nullifying commentators, the fallacy of the claim will at once be seen. The resolution in the following words are that, and this is paragraph 19, that the good people of the Commonwealth, having ever felt the continuing to feel the most sincere affection to their brethren of the other states, the truest anxiety for establishing the perpetuating union for all, and the most scrupulous fidelity to that Constitution, which is the pledge of mutual friendship and the instrument of mutual happiness, the General Assembly doth solemnly appeal to the like dispositions of the other states, in confidence that they will concur with this Commonwealth in declaring, as it does hereby declare, that the fact that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional, and that the necessary proper measures will be taken by each for cooperating with this state in maintaining unimpaired the authorities and rights and liberties reserved in the states respectively or to the people, close quote. So he's basically reinforcing the fact that the states must unify and unite on these fundamental principles. Isn't that amazing? We'll be right back after this promo.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, now we're going into paragraph 20, and this is where he ties the 7th and the 3rd resolution together. He says, here it distinctly appears as in the 3rd resolution, because he just read the 7th. And he says, it distinctively appears as in the 3rd resolution that the course contemplated by the legislature, quote, for maintaining the authorities, rights, and liberties reserved to the states, again, plural, he's saying states, plural, respectively, close quote, was not a solitary or separate interposition, but a cooperation in the means necessary and proper for the purpose. So this is why, folks, you know, most people hear me say, you know, this homeschooling is a form of nullification. It is a great thing to save your children from this indoctrination. All parents, if every parent in the United States decided to homeschool, would that solve the problem? No. As a matter of fact, what would end up happening is would force the federal government to become more tyrannical and to seize and basically start creating the Department of Babysitting instead of the Department of Education. And they would come in and rip your children out of your homes and indoctrinate them that way. It would probably implement rules and laws like what was implemented in the Soviet Union when they destroyed the families completely. That's coming around because we're not actually addressing the real problem. Now, I say this because just like when I started this out yesterday and I talked about how counties had, you know, claimed to interpose, but what they actually did, interposition was the right thing to do. Absolutely. That's what has to happen. But that's not what happened in the cases of, I think it's Newton County and what the other county was in Illinois. I could look up those things, but it doesn't matter. What really matters is the fact that what they did was they nullified. They said, we're not going to enforce these laws, but they failed. They failed. I believe, you know, people should actually use civil unrest when we are finally at that point. I mean, this is why when I look at the racial discrimination and what was occurring, where you have no other recourse but to use civil unrest. It's not that you were actually breaking the constitutional laws. You were violating unconstitutional laws that were being passed. You know, and I've gone through this. Any restaurant that is open to the public cannot reserve and create separate but equal situations, even though the court said that that's, you know, they'll allow that that's permissible. It's not. Every person, when they walk in that door, FIFO is embedded in American doctrine. First in, first out. And when corporations, I mean, it's one thing for you to do it in a private manner, but when a corporation starts actually playing and violating FIFO, then they're failing to actually protect your right. I mean, have you ever had a case where you were scheduled and the company, because of some bad circumstance, basically says, we're really sorry, we have to reschedule and we have to put you out a month or two just due to the fact of rescheduling you instead of affecting everybody? And that's exactly what they should have done. They should have affected everybody and said, we're really sorry, but we had a circumstance and we can't just hurt one, our employee or our customer who was rightfully in the front of the line and push them back to the back of the line just so that we don't have to manage a tough schedule. Now, if that would have been anybody that was in that line, the closer they are to being next, like the customer that's the next day that would have been served. Oh, well, I don't want that to happen. But the further back you go, the more reasonable, the more righteous people start becoming and saying, I wouldn't have wanted that to happen to me. If I got bumped, especially the people that are three, four weeks away, if that would have been me, I really would have appreciated the fact, because I'm already having to wait this long. I would have really appreciated the fact that they took care of me next, even though they had the circumstance that they couldn't do this body of work. And this has happened to me. It's happened to my wife and I, my beautiful bride. We had to go through this. And I go, I can't believe you're doing this to us. They already have our money. We already paid in advance to have this work done. And then they impact us by doing that. I think that they should have, created much greater compensation to us, but they did nothing. And so that company, who happened to be, I'd tell you the name if you want to know it. I'm not going to just blurt it out, but the company that practices these types of principles, and they're not the only ones. There's way too many companies that practice that principle. And it is unjust. But bottom line, when it comes down to what Madison is saying, he is saying we all have to cooperate. We all have to demand that the process be maintained. So how hard is it if all of a sudden something goes south? You just have everything. Everybody pushes a day. Sorry. If you're unable to deal with that, we're sorry. But we can't do injustice to a customer. It may seem like an injustice to you, and we're sorry. But we can't do that because it would be a perceived injustice that would ripple beyond. And I honestly believe that any business that actually fails to embrace FIFO, because first in, first out is the process. Anyway, in further elucidation, this is paragraph 21. In further elucidation or in further clarification of the view of the legislature could be needed, it happens to be found in its recorded proceeding in the 7th resolution, as originally proposed, the term unconstitutional was followed by null and void, etc. Null, void, and etc. These words added, or these added words being considered by some as giving pretext for some disorganizing the misconstruction, were unanimously stricken, or rather withdrawn, by the mover of the resolution. So what he just did was he gave you insights. These are absolute insights of what happened while he was working with the state legislature in trying to pound out these resolutions. Before the resolutions were formed, the language of adding nullification and etc. In other words, what I'm telling you folks here is that Madison is clearly pointing out that the intent of putting those words would have created a misconstruction, and it was absolutely unacceptable that these words themselves would have created a misconstruction, and most people would have thought it be a single state's right. They needed to maintain focus on unity and the union, that it needed to actually point to all states to do this. An attempt has been made as ascribing to the word stricken out a nullifying signification to fix on the reputed draftsman of the resolution the character of a nullifier. Okay, what he just said was the fact that he has been labeled, and today, folks, I hate to say this, but there are good people out there that are actually, they've been bought into and believe that Madison was an advocate for nullification. As a matter of fact, and I'll you know, the John Birch Society has a group of different speakers that go around that push this. And as a matter of fact, Alex Newman, because I've communicated with him, and I'll share my emails with anybody, I communicated with him the clarity that James Madison was never an advocate for nullification. He understood that the only way we could save the Union is through interposition, not going down this path of anarchy. And so, you know, he didn't know. Alex Newman, because I, like I said, I'll share these emails. He was really relying upon other experts to tell him to do something and say something else, that yet Madison was an advocate for it. And I gave him these documents, but I don't think he either read them or he understood this part right here. This is huge. I can't say it any clearer. What Madison says right here, he completely, as far as I'm concerned, he defends his honor and reputation of his as well as Jefferson's. And I'm going to reread this. This is paragraph 23, folks. Anybody that wants to claim that Madison was in favor, because he's saying right here that it's actually destroyed, or they've tried to tarnish his reputation in saying this. An attempt has been made by ascribing to the word stricken out a nullifying signification to fix on the repudiated draftsman of the revolution or the resolution. Who was that repudiated draftsman? Who was that? That was Madison. In other words, Madison is basically in a sideways saying, hey, they tried to blame me, and how dare they? The character of a nullifier. Could this have been affected, it would have been vindicated by the state legislature more effectually from the imputation of favoring the doctrine of South Carolina. The unanimous eraser of nullification expressions was a protest by the House of Delegates in the most emphatic form against it. So what do we have? So what we have is we have this concept that even though Madison was the draftsman of the resolution and the character of the nullifier that came up and said, hey, we need to do this, you know, would have actually tarnished that because it was his name on it. You got to remember that even though you're doing something, there's a lot of people that inject something. And, you know, when we look at the Kentucky resolutions, who do we refer to the inference of what was being said? Oh, well, these are all Jefferson's words. Madison kind of knew that the Virginia resolutions, when he went in there, he was not a member of the committee. He was not a member of the General Assembly. He was there as a guiding participant, as, you know, like what I'm doing now, somebody that's not a part of the team, but I'm here guiding people and helping them understand what they need to do and giving them the truth. And I'm not making anything up. This is why I demand that you hear and read the words of what these men said instead of listening to anybody that tells you what they said. Because when somebody comes along and pretends that Madison was in support of nullification, then that right there is an indictment of somebody misleading you. Oh, well, don't take, you know, take our word for it. This is how I am being reputed all the time by those who do not like my criticism, i.e. the Convention of State folks. They don't like my criticism, so they're repudiating me. They're trying to. They're trying to misconstruct what Republic Review is. And actually what they're doing is they're creating ad hominem attacks. The John Birch Society is doing the same thing. every organization that I point my finger at and call them out as myopic organizations and contributors to keeping us from uniting, keeping the patriots, the good patriotic Americans of this union, in uniting and demanding full compliance to their constitution, these, the leaders, not the people of these organizations. I emphatically want you to understand this, that we have, these organizations have good managers that do what they're told. If you fail to do what you're told, then you're out. And now you no longer reap the blessings that come from on high. And this is how I've seen, you know, the president of the American Policy Center actually get ousted. And when he needed, you know, to be able to go and do speeches and do circuits, he had to dance the tune. In other words, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so these organizations basically play hardball and say, you can't, we're not going to let you come on our speaking circuit unless you support or you do what we tell you to, and you have to go against Republic Review, you have to go against Interposition, you have to basically take a stand and claim the GR is misleading you or lying. The reason, the fact is, and I said this last Friday, the fact of the matter is that nobody can refute what I'm telling you, because I am actually telling you what the framers are telling you. That's why they can't refute this. There's not one nullifier out there that can say otherwise, but they will continue to tell you that Madison and Jefferson were in support of nullification. Why is this? Because they have everything to lose. I can't say it any plainer. These organizations, so, and I think I lent to this, how the Eagles Forum does not feel threatened by Republic Review or Interposition. So they're not taking a position. They're not going around trying to mislead everybody to say, don't listen to this guy. Now, maybe the new formed Eagle Forum, not the old guard, but the new formed Eagle Forum, because they're in bed with the convention states, may become players of misleading people. They may be the manager of a bad agenda. But a true leader recognizes the truth and takes a stand on those core principles of truth that we all acknowledge and we all embrace. That's what a true leader does. And unfortunately, when I see local managers for an organization, regardless of what it is, and they actually get message from on high, GR is a threat to us. His Republic Review is a threat. You must get people to see him as a threat. Oh, he's out to make money. They make all sorts of false accusations. Or they'll try to, oh, well, you know, we read his book and he used this term that the call for a constitutional convention. Folks, if you read the citation, it's a small c, small c. In other words, small constitution, small convention, not the formal, quote, capital constitutional, capital convention, which is a very specific process. It's an Article 5 constitutional convention. They don't like the ambiguity in how I wrote that first book. And I've come out and I've said this several times. I was so naive when I wrote that book because I didn't realize how evil had permeated throughout the ranks of the patriots, where we had organizations that started playing this controlled opposition where, okay, we'll take this side, you take that side, and we will, you know, we'll bully anybody that doesn't agree with us. And so we'll work together to team against those people that want to, you know, shine light on anything other than your path and our path. And we will bully each other and we'll attack each other, because that's the hyperbole of this dialogue. But the fact is, and that's why I'm going to get into what do we really do? And this is really going to be more, and I'm considering rewriting the argument for Republic Review by including this new presentation that I'm doing, because I'm putting it all on the table, folks. There are six paths. There are six ways of dealing with federal problems. The only way to deal with federal overreach is exactly what Madison and Jefferson are talking about. This is why they didn't nullify. This is why they didn't convene a convention. This is why they don't go into a court. And as a matter of fact, when we look at all the other myopic resistance folks, you know, whether it be the abortion or the Constitutional Alliance, they choose to use the court system. And we all know the court system's failed. We all know it's corrupt. Why actually surrender to a court system that has aggrandized itself and has operated well outside the boundaries of the Constitution as well? I mean, come on. There's the party in the elections, and the party is out there, you know, they're playing their games as well. There is only one path and one path alone. So when we go through this, if you think I'm wrong, then please, you know, attack my argument. But if you're not attacking my argument and you're trying to make me look bad like I have faults, folks, I'm going to tell you, in my youth, I happened to date some women that had questionable character. I myself had questionable character because I was immature and stupid. So you'll always find faults with anybody. I've said this for so many times and so many years. I've been going on about this. We have to get over the fact that somebody's a sinner. Who among us haven't sinned? We need to actually look at the heart, the message, and the subject and context of what somebody is doing. And that is what is important. So anyway, let me move back into focused on this. I've got about 7 minutes left. But let us, and this is paragraph 24, but let us turn to the quote-unquote report, which explained and vindicated the resolutions and observe the light in which it placed first the third and then the seventh resolutions. He doesn't say the resolutions, he just, seventh period. So because he thinks by this time most people get it, but that's what he's talking about, the third and seventh, because that's what he's been citing. That's what he cited so far in this document. It must be recollected that this document, he's talking about the Virginia resolutions, proceeded from representatives chosen by the people some months after the resolutions had been before them, with a longer period for manifesting their sentiments before the report was adopted and without any evidence of the disapprobation in the constituent body. On the contrary, it is known to have been received by the Republican Party, a decided majority of the people, with the most entire approbation. In other words, the most entire agreement. Now, I'm pointing out right here, folks, that notice he didn't say the Democratic Party or the Democratic Republican Party. He says, by the Republican Party. He and Jefferson, this is Madison and Jefferson, the two of them, in 1792, created the Republican Party. Anybody that tells you it arose under Lincoln, they're lying to you. They don't want you to recognize the significant difference of how Lincoln completely changed the platform and the intent behind the Republican Party, because it became a draconian big government party. We will do what we want. You will do what we tell you to do. A decided majority of the people within the most entire approbation. So in other words, they all decided and agreed with the Republican Party. And actually the reason he's pointing this out is because how did the election fare? More people agreed and voted Republican in the 1800 election. The Republican Party. So this is what I said in 2020. I told the Constitution Party, if you lead on the Constitution and you start demanding compliance of the Constitution, you will have an impact and you will wake everybody up. And they didn't do that. Now, we had the chair in Missouri do that, but he didn't have the whole party behind him. As a matter of fact, if you look at his campaign for the Senate, he did not have, you know, much enthusiasm at all. I mean, there were some members that did what they could, but they're limited. they didn't actually get buoyed up and in supporting this full compliance. Now, granted, we only had a few petitions, but I think, you know, you can actually start creating the petitions in your head and realizing how important it is to petition government and hold it accountable and make it comply to the Constitution. So moving on in paragraph 25, Madison says, "The report, therefore, must be regarded as the most authoritative evidence of the meaning attached by the state of the resolutions. This consideration makes it more extraordinary, and let it be added, more inexcusable in those who, in their zeal to extract a particular meaning from a particular resolution, not only shut their eyes to another resolution, but to an authentic exposition of both." In other words, those people that want to play their game in saying, well, we see this, or we believe it means this. And so paragraph 26, Madison, it's just one line. He just says, "And what is the comment of the report on that particular resolution, namely the third?" And then he goes on to the 27th paragraph and says, "In the first place, it conforms to the resolution in using the terms which expresses the interposing authority of the states." I mean, he's again highlighting interposition, not nullification, in the plural number states, not in the singular number state. Again, he's just completely re-emphasizing the plurality that the states must interpose. It is needed impossible not only to perceive that the entire current and complexion of the observations explaining and vindicating the resolutions imply necessarily that by the interposition of the states for arresting the evil of usurpation was meant to a concurring authority, not to that of a single state, whilst the collective meaning of the term gives a consistency and effect to the reasoning of the object. What else can I say, folks? I mean, he really harangues it right there. But he continues and goes on. And he says in the paragraph 28, "But besides this general evidence that the report in the invariable use of the plural term states withheld from a single state, the right expressed in the resolution a still more precise and decisive inference to the same effect is afforded by several passages in the document." Now, I've got less than a minute here, and so I'm not going to have time to go through paragraph 29. So when we come back tomorrow, we will be going through paragraph 29 and taking it from there, because I just want to be very succinct as we move forward, just for the sake of what time we have left in the year, so that I will be ready and prepared to give you the rest of the content that we need when it comes to legislative session, because we're going to be talking about these bills that are going into, I'm hoping and praying that Wyoming and South Dakota will push forward in being consistent in demanding these federal review committees and so forth, as well as basically highlighting this monopoly that the nullifiers and the conventionites have called for in trying to get people to choose one of two bad paths. Oh, well, support this path or that path. Like, if there's only two, there are six. And this is why we're going to highlight this. And we have to make clarity so that all legislators start realizing that they really need to put this into perspective. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.